Hello and welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. Just after noon on Wednesday, September 10th, the fountain courtyard at Utah Valley University, the stepped lawn and water feature tucked between the Hall of Flags, the Fugle Gateway, and the Sorensen Center, was already shoulder to shoulder. A small pop-up stage sat on the grass, framed by the concrete terraces and the Wasatch foothills beyond, as students and locals pressed up to the rails and queued behind them. The weather added a buzz of its own. Bright late summer sun and warm, dry air that pushed into the mid-80s by early afternoon, with only a light breeze cutting the heat. By 12:05, the crowd, roughly 3,000 strong, was chanting his name, phones lifted, hats waving, and when Charlie Kirk stepped out a few minutes later and tossed a handful of hats into the pit, the place erupted with the kind of crackling, pep rally energy that makes a campus courtyard feel like a stadium just before kickoff. Soon after, however, tragedy struck. While speaking to the crowd about violence in the transgender community, Kirk was struck with a sniper's bullet. In an ironic twist, the bulletproof vest Kirk was wearing under his shirt to protect him reflected the bullet through his neck and severed his jugular vein. As panic and confusion spread through the crowd, Kirk was taken to a vehicle and rushed to Timpanogos Regional Hospital, where the 31-year-old founder and CEO of Turning Point USA and a prominent conservative activist closely allied with President Donald Trump was pronounced dead a short time later. The incident was described by Utah Governor Spencer Cox as a political assassination, and the suspect was arrested shortly after. Kirk's death prompted widespread vigils, tributes from figures like Trump, who planned to award him a posthumous Presidential Medal of Freedom. In a public address, his widow Erica Kirk has vowed to continue his legacy. Authorities are pursuing the death penalty for the suspect amid broader concerns about rising political violence in the United States, and it is that topic, political violence, that brings us to today's episode. As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you prefer as we look at two other prominent assassinations, both of which occurred in the 1960s. In the summer of 1963, civil rights leader Medgar Evers was murdered in his driveway in Mississippi. Just 5 years later, Senator Robert F. Kennedy was gunned down in Los Angeles after celebrating victory in the California Democratic primary. Both deaths devastated families and communities, but they also changed the course of U.S. history. Tonight, we'll step into those moments, explore the world that followed, and ask, what might have been if their voices had not been silenced? It was just after midnight on June 12, 1963. Medgar Evers, exhausted from a long day of organizing, drove into the driveway of his modest home in Jackson, Mississippi. He had been at the NAACP office, pushing forward voter registration efforts and carrying home a box of T-shirts printed with the words, "Jim Crow must go." As he stepped from his car, a rifle shot cracked the night air. The bullet struck him in the back, shattering his body. Evers staggered a few steps toward his door before collapsing on the ground. His wife, Merle, and their children rushed outside, their screams piercing the quiet night. Within the hour, at a local hospital that initially turned him away because of his race, Medgar Evers was pronounced dead. He was only 37 years old. Evers was more than a local activist. A veteran of World War II, he had fought for democracy abroad only to return to a segregated South. As the NAACP's first field secretary in Mississippi, he became a relentless force for change, organizing boycotts, recruiting members, and fighting segregation in the courts. He supported James Meredith's historic integration of the University of Mississippi, and his prominence made him a constant target of hate. His murder was a national shock, but it also became a spark. Just weeks later, Martin Luther King Jr. led the March on Washington, delivering his famous "I Have a Dream" speech. Had Evers lived, he almost certainly would have been there, giving national voice to the Mississippi struggle. Instead, we can only wonder how his absence changed the civil rights struggle. 3 years after his death, James Meredith began his March Against Fear. The March Against Fear began on June 5, 1966, when James Meredith set out alone from Memphis to Jackson to prove that black Mississippians could claim public space without terror and to spur voter registration along the way. On June 6, a white gunman ambushed and wounded him, prompting leaders from several civil rights organizations to continue the 220-mile trek in Meredith's name. As the column moved through Delta towns, it mixed mass meetings with door-to-door canvassing and medical voter registration stations, drawing national figures and local families alike. The march became both a moving classroom and a measure of power, testing how far black communities could push for dignity and political voice on Mississippi's back roads in the wake of landmark civil rights laws. When Meredith was shot, King and Stokely Carmichael took up the march. Along the way, Carmichael popularized the slogan, Black Power, after his arrest in Greenwood, Mississippi, marking a turn toward militancy and nationalism. Would Medgar Evers, a disciplined NAACP organizer, have tried to bridge this growing divide between King's tactic of nonviolence and the emerging militancy of black nationalism? Would he have pushed to hold the movement together as it fractured between integrationist and nationalist visions? This becomes one of those what-if debates that can never find a consensus view. Historian Elizabeth Hinton gives us one more lens. In her book, America on Fire, she documents an astonishing 1,949 separate uprisings in black communities between 1968 and 1972. Without Evers's pragmatic leadership, the civil rights struggle entered this turbulent era without one of its most steadying voices. His absence left the movement to navigate that storm without him, and history unfolded down a different path. Of course, King's own tragic assassination at the hands of a white supremacist on April 4, 1968, was a devastating loss on its own. Sadly, King's murder would be followed by the killing of the presidential nominee of the Democrat Party just a month later. It was just after midnight on June 5, 1968. In the ballroom of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, Robert F. Kennedy had just declared victory in the California Democratic primary. The crowd thundered as he told supporters, "Now it's on to Chicago and let's win there." Smiling, he left the podium, walking through a kitchen pantry on his way to meet the press. Suddenly, gunshots tore through the narrow hallway. Kennedy collapsed, bleeding from a head wound. As panic spread, hotel busboy Juan Romero knelt beside him, cradling his head and whispering, "Don't worry, Senator, everything will be okay." But it wasn't. Within 26 hours, Robert Kennedy was dead. He was 42 years old. Robert Kennedy had already left a mark on American life. As Attorney General, he pressed civil rights enforcement further than any of his predecessors. As Senator, he became an advocate for the poor, for Native communities, and for Latino farm workers, even breaking bread with Cesar Chavez during his hunger strike in 1968. He was also an increasingly outspoken critic of the Vietnam War. The what-ifs surrounding Kennedy are among the most tantalizing in modern American history. Nixon's election that year ushered in a new era of law and order politics, the Southern Strategy, and continued conflict in Vietnam. Would an RFK presidency have accelerated the end of the war? Could he have bridged America's widening racial divides at a moment when black power and black nationalism were on the rise? And what of the Chicano movement? 1968 was the year of the East Los Angeles walkouts, when thousands of Mexican-American students demanded equal education. In the years that followed, the Chicano movement gained strength, pushing for civil rights, labor justice, and political recognition. Kennedy had already stood publicly with Chavez and the farm workers. It is easy to imagine him legitimizing and accelerating Mexican-American political empowerment, giving the movement the same national recognition that civil rights leaders had begun to secure. Instead, under Nixon, these movements often met suspicion, surveillance, and repression. Kennedy's broad coalition, uniting African-Americans, Latinos, working-class whites, and young voters, vanished overnight, and with it, perhaps, the possibility of a very different America. Instead of the possibility of peaceful progress in the civil rights struggle of Hispanics in the U.S., we got the reality of the Nixon administration and the violence during the Chicano moratorium. On August 29, 1970, between 20,000 and 30,000 people, students, families, veterans, labor, and community groups gathered in East Los Angeles to protest the Vietnam War and its disproportionate toll on Mexican-American youth. Organized by the National Chicano Moratorium Committee, the march proceeded several miles along East LA streets to Laguna Park, renamed Ruben F. Salazar Park soon after, where a rally featured speeches, music, and a festival-like atmosphere. The action was the largest anti-war demonstration led by a community of color to that point, and a high-water mark of Chicano movement coalition building. Although the march itself was peaceful, the day turned deadly. As the rally continued, Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies moved in, citing a report of a nearby liquor store disturbance. They declared the assembly unlawful and advanced on the park. What followed was a rapid escalation: tear gas, baton charges, and running clashes that spilled onto Whittier Boulevard, with bystanders and marchers scattering amid chaos. By day's end, hundreds were arrested and scores injured. Contemporaries and later historians widely characterized the confrontation as a police riot. The most searing moment came away from the main stage. Ruben Salazar, a groundbreaking Los Angeles Times columnist and news director at KMEX, had stepped into the Silver Dollar Cafe on Whittier to take a brief break from covering the turmoil. A sheriff's deputy fired a 10-inch wall-piercing tear gas projectile through the cafe's curtained doorway. It struck Salazar in the head and killed him instantly. His death galvanized the Chicano movement and made Salazar an enduring symbol of both journalistic courage and state violence. A coroner's inquest deemed it death at the hands of another. Three people died as a result of the events on August 29th. Ruben Salazar, teenager Lynn Ward, and Jose Angel Diaz. Many accounts also remember Gustav Montag, who was killed at a follow-up protest months later. The park's renaming in Salazar's honor acknowledged both the tragedy and the community's demand for memory and accountability. The moratorium's legacy endures in scholarship, commemorations, and cultural production, where it stands as a pivotal moment linking anti-war dissent to broader struggles against police brutality and racial inequality in the American West. The great what-if debate revolves around Robert Kennedy. Would his credibility as a civil rights icon and his vision of a more equal American society been enough of a factor to avoid the violence and bring about progress peacefully? Kennedy once stated, "There are those who look at things the way they are and ask why. I dream of things that never were and ask why not." Medgar Evers and Robert Kennedy will forever be connected by their similarities. Both were civil rights icons. Both worked tirelessly to bring about equality peacefully, and both had their lives cut short by political assassins before they could see their dreams become reality. Two very different nights. One in a Mississippi driveway. One in a Los Angeles ballroom. Both ended in sudden silence, and both redirected American history. Evers' death became a rallying cry, helping carry the Civil Rights Act into law. Yet his absence left the movement without a key voice, just as it faced the rise of militancy and nationwide uprisings. Kennedy's death robbed the nation of a leader who might have bridged divides, ended a war sooner, and accelerated the political rise of Mexican Americans. Assassinations do more than end lives. They change trajectories. They reshape movements, fracture coalitions, and leave behind haunting questions. What would Medgar Evers have said as the movement turned toward the militancy of black nationalism? What would Robert Kennedy have done as the Chicano movement gathered strength? History cannot answer, but imagining those possibilities reveals how fragile and how contingent our path has always been. And that leads us to today. Charlie Kirk, too, was a political force that comes along once in a generation. His work at TPUSA reached an untold number of young college students, and he gave a voice to the conservative movement that will resonate long after his death. But perhaps most of all, his fight for the right of conservative voices to be heard on college campuses convinced many students on the right to stand up and make a stand for their beliefs and not hide in the shadows and just quietly exist on campus. His wife Erica has vowed to continue his work and expand the movement he created. And there can be no doubt that the conservative movement will not only gain strength from his martyrdom, but it will also adjust its trajectory in a way that only future historians will be able to look back and chart with any sense of accuracy. We can predict, but no one has a crystal ball. At this point, we can only hope that when the anger subsides, we will collectively make a stand against violence and intimidation in the political process, and instead increase the dialogue between the opposing sides of the political spectrum. Charlie Kirk stated over and over that when dialogue stops, violence begins. If his work and his death can bring about an increase in debate and dialogue, that will be his greatest legacy of all. That concludes this episode. Please like and subscribe and leave a comment if there is anything you would like to add to the debate. If there is a topic you would like to see covered, please leave a note as well. Sources for this episode and suggested readings can be found at the show notes as rootsoftoday.blog. Finally, fight to keep your political representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.